We are tonight going to be discussing the art of oratory and the related art of rhetoric. Are they the same or are they different? That will shortly appear in conversation with our guest, an old friend, David Zarefsky, who is these days professor of communications at Northwestern University. And we're going to hear we're going to read a few things, aren't we, David?
Yes,
indeed. Begin. You're going to be Pericles, I'm going to be Cicero. But most of what we have is in recording, and we'll be hearing various eminentos as they address the public. But I want to test something out on you first. With regard to rhetoric and oratory, Thomas Carlyle, the great English essayist of the early 19th century, says this: the orator persuades and carries all with him, he knows not how. The rhetorician can prove that he ought to have persuaded and carried all with him. So the orator, he's saying, has sort of a natural gift, which is in a way a gift to the gods. He doesn't work it up systematically and with consciousness. It just flows.
Often the great orators come by their art intuitively. They can't really explain what it is that they're doing or why, and yet there are underlying principles that the rhetorician, the theorist, will try to make clear.
And if you go back to ancient Western civilization, to the beginnings, if you go back to Greece and Rome, you find treatises on rhetoric. We find people who are teachers of rhetoric, just as you are in this latter day.
Yes, indeed. This is an art that goes back at least 2,500 years. There are classical Greek treatises that are still read today. Plato has a couple dialogues on rhetoric. Probably the most significant book on rhetoric ever written was by Aristotle. And these are works that people continue to study and to derive insight from.
Well, we're going to see just what they have to say about rhetoric or about oratory, about the nature of verbal persuasion. That's what we're talking about. But first, we're going to get some examples of great speeches from a long time ago. One of the first ones in the Western canon that we know of is the one that you're about to read a portion of.
That's right. And this is Pericles' funeral oration delivered in the 5th century B.C., as reported by Thucydides. We don't know if this is actually what Pericles said, but Thucydides heard it and was sympathetic to Pericles.
Pericles is the mayor daily of 5th century Athens.
Yes, indeed.
So to speak.
Yes.
He commands a lot of public respect.
That's correct.
Though his oratory probably was rather different from either daily senior or daily junior.
Certainly was. Certainly was.
Yet they've got a sort of a common touch, which also commends them to the interest and even to the approval of hundreds of thousands of Chicagoans.
Well, and that's the thing about rhetoric, is it ultimately depends upon establishing a strong connection between the speaker and the audience.
Let's hear this famous oration by Pericles, but explain for us what the occasion is.
The occasion is the memorial for the soldiers who were killed in the first year of the Peloponnesian War. And this public memorial was an established ritual. Someone would deliver a speech, and then all of the surviving bones would be buried. And Pericles does that on this occasion. I'm going to read a paragraph that's actually from in the middle of the speech, when he's trying to explain that it's not just that these bones are buried here, but that there's a much larger significance to the lives of the soldiers. He says, "For the whole earth is the sepulcher of illustrious men. Nor is it the inscription on the columns in their native land alone that shows their merit, but the memorial of them, better than all inscriptions in every foreign nation, reposited more durably in universal remembrance than on their own tombs. From this very moment, emulating these noble patterns, placing your happiness in liberty, and liberty in valor, be prepared to encounter all the dangers of war. For to be lavish of life is not so noble in those whom misfortunes have reduced to misery and despair, as in men who hazard the loss of a comfortable subsistence and the enjoyment of all the blessings this world affords by an unsuccessful enterprise. Adversity, after a series of ease and affluence, sinks deeper into the heart of a man of spirit than the stroke of death insensibly received in the vigor of life and public hope."
So he's reconciling the survivors with the death of their loved ones.
Exactly. And this really establishes the conventions of the funeral oration, that it both memorializes the dead and consoles the living while giving them inspiration and advice.
How would you compare that to a speech on a similar occasion 2,400 years later, The Gettysburg Address.
The Gettysburg Address is very much a funeral oration. It's delivered on a similar kind of occasion, the dedication of a cemetery where war dead are to be buried. And Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address follows just about the same formula as Pericles in the funeral oration. It combines tribute to the dead with advice for the living.
But in shorter form.
In much shorter form, 272 words.
Whereas that speech by Pericles probably would have run for an hour or so.
At least.
At least as we have it transcribed or imagined by Thucydides himself. I am now looking for, in a book that I've got in front of me, the speech by Cicero. But would you set this just a bit? It's the first oration against Catiline. Who was Catiline? What was going on?
Well, Cicero and Catiline were political opponents. Cicero was received word that Catiline was bribing people to vote for and support him, and this was exposed. And when it was exposed, Catiline arguably was organizing a conspiracy to assassinate Cicero. Cicero got word of it and delayed the election where all this would be played out so that he could make his case to the assembly against Catiline, which he does in a series of speeches, of which this is the first. This is 63 B.C.
Exactly. They're both members of the Roman Senate. And Cicero is a famous orator, though this helps to establish his fame as an orator.
That's right.
Doesn't it?
That's right.
He's got four speeches against Catiline. This is the first. He goes on the attack instantly. What's so fascinating about this is that he's going for blood.
Right from the start.
At the moment that he begins.
Right from the start.
And here is the opening. When, O Catiline, do you mean to cease abusing our patience? How long is that madness of yours still to mock us? When is there to be an end of that unbridled audacity of yours, swaggering about as it does now? Do not the mighty guards placed on the Palatine Hill, do not the watches posted throughout the city, does not the alarm of the people and the union of all good men, does not the precaution taken of assembling the Senate in this most defensible place, do not the looks and countenances of this venerable body here present have any effect upon you? Do you not feel that your plans are detected? Do you not see that your conspiracy is already arrested and rendered powerless by the knowledge which everyone here possesses of it? What is there that you did last night? What the night before? Where is it that you were? Who was there that you summoned to meet you? What design was there which was adopted by you, with which you think that any one of us is unacquainted? Shame on the age and on its principles. Isn't that in the Latin, O tempora, O mores?
I believe so.
Yeah. The Senate is aware of these things. The council sees them. And yet this man lives. Lives. Aye, he comes even into the Senate. He takes a part in the public deliberations. He is watching and marking down and checking off for slaughter every individual among us. And we, gallant men that we are, think that we are doing our duty to the Republic if we keep out of the way of his frenzied attacks. You ought, O Catiline, long ago to have been led to execution by command of the council. That destruction which you have long been plotting against us ought to have already fallen on your own head. Pretty strong stuff.
Pretty strong stuff.
What happened?
Well, in the speech, if you go on, what happens is that Cicero begins by addressing Catiline directly, although he's speaking in the Senate, but he broadens his apparent audience as he goes along, so that everybody is brought in, and it is a plea for Catiline's execution, which the Senate ultimately votes for. Catiline fled, refused to submit to his execution, and was killed in battle about a year or so later.
Which is an augury of something that will happen to Cicero.
That's right.
A while later. We'll talk about that. Time to pause for the... What's a good oratorical way of introducing commercials? I just say we pause for these words.
Well, I don't know.
How would Cicero bring on the commercials? Here, O Romans! And we are tonight talking about high talk. We're talking about oratory, which is persuasive argument or persuasive representation of a side of an issue or of many issues. And as we noted earlier, some of the great philosophers and other, and historians for that matter, of classical antiquity addressed the question of rhetoric and became experts on how you persuade other people, how to do this thing. And you mentioned earlier that both Aristotle and Plato are very much interested in the art of oratory.
That's right, and it's interesting, we've been reading some classical speeches that about the same time those speeches were delivered was when the theory of rhetoric was being formulated and developed. In Greece in the 4th and 5th century B.C., particularly in the 4th century, mm-hmm. is when Aristotle wrote. Aristotle, among other things, develops a theory of different genres or types of address that correspond to different occasions. So, for example, the funeral oration that we read mm-hmm. from Pericles illustrates what Aristotle called the epideictic genre, the ceremonial genre. That was always focused in the present, was concerned with praise and blame and formulating advice from example and precept. And so what we've got is on one side Aristotle developing this theoretically, and on the other side Pericles illustrating it in practice. And similarly, Cicero, who was a distinguished and noted orator, was also a theorist of rhetoric. And at the same time that he was delivering these speeches, he was writing books like De Inventione on how you find materials for proof and how you organize a speech and the different parts and how they fit together, so that his practice and his theory pretty much reinforced each other. So this really was the golden age in the development of this whole art. And one of the things that made it so prominent is there were not professional lawyers to plead a case for you. There weren't professional politicians. There weren't professional speech writers. These were things that citizens were expected to be able to do as they came together to deliberate on public questions, either directly or in representative bodies.
Well, the government of Athens, before it was knocked over, was, of course, a democracy. But it was a total true democracy in that all citizens, and not all residents were citizens, but all citizens were allowed to come to the meeting of what did they call the general body? It was like a town, like a New England town meeting. Everybody comes in and expresses his views if he chooses. Socrates himself, of course, was tried by, I guess, the assembly, mm-hmm. Athenian assembly, and was condemned to death.
That's right. That's right.
It was 400 or 500 people.
That's right. And in this kind of an environment, not to be able to express yourself well and convincingly mm-hmm. and forcefully was a character defect, because you weren't able to function very well in the society. So that created the need for instruction and understanding of how to do it, and that's where the theory of rhetoric derived from.
And we still teach it. Don't people like you still teach rhetoric in the terms laid out by Aristotle, by Cicero, and so on?
Absolutely. Now, we know some things that Aristotle and Cicero didn't.
Yeah.
There are some areas where we've advanced on their insights, but the texts that they wrote are still very much taught, and not just as historical works, but also for their continuing value.
One wonders whether Shakespeare, who did have, Ben Jonson said, little Latin and less Greek, but in fact got a fairly good classical education in the English public schools of his time, one wonders whether he knew those theories of rhetoric when he composed, say, his classical plays, particularly Julius Caesar, which there are a number of speeches, the most famous being Mark Antony's funeral oration directly after the assassination of Caesar.
That's right. And while there's all kinds of disputes about who actually wrote Shakespeare and so on, if you take the work, it reflects pretty well the classical understanding of the rhetorical arts.
We're going to listen to Mark Antony's funeral oration. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Most halfway educated people at least have heard of that and may even recognize a few of the lines. But set that for us, would you?
Well, this comes following the assassination.
Where most of the senators, led by Brutus and Cassius, have ganged up and stabbed Caesar to death. His good friend Mark Antony is not in on the plot.
That's right. That's right.
But then he asks permission to show the body to the public, who are assembled and are enraged and confused outside the Roman Forum, and to speak of Caesar's virtues.
And in the process, changes the attitude of the body.
Yes. Rouses. Well, first they have heard from Brutus.
Defending the murder.
Gives the reasons why they had to kill Caesar,
right,
even though they loved him.
That's right.
Because he wanted to be a dictator, and that would wreck our republic. And then on comes Mark Antony, with the permission of Brutus and those other good men, honorable men of truth. And he plays with that very concept about them.
Yes.
Here it is.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man, so are they all honorable men, come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome, whose ransoms did the general coffers fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept, ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious. And sure, he is an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? Oh, judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me. My heart is in the coffin there with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me.
Methinks there is much reason in his sayings.
Thou consider rightly of the matter. Caesar has had great wrong.
Has he, Marcus? I fear there will a worse come in his place.
Mark ye his words. He would not take the crown, therefore it certainly was not ambitious.
If the crown sunk, some will dare abide it.
Poor soul, his eyes are red as fire with weeping.
There's not a nobler man in Rome than Antony.
Romans!
Now mark him! He begins again to speak.
But yesterday, the word of Caesar might have stood against the world. Now lies he there, and none so poor to do him reverence. Oh, masters! If I were disposed to stir your hearts and minds to mutiny and rage, I should do Brutus wrong and Cassius wrong, who you all know are honorable men. I will not do them wrong. I rather choose to wrong the dead, to wrong myself and you, than I will wrong such honorable men. But here's a parchment with the seal of Caesar. I found it in his closet. 'Tis his will. Let but the commons hear this testament, which, pardon me, I do not mean to read. And they would go and kiss dead Caesar's wounds, and dip their napkins in his sacred blood. Yea, beg a hair of him for memory, and dying, mention it within their wills, bequeathing it as a rich legacy unto their issue.
We'll hear the will.
It's a crime to not complete that one. It's one of the great set pieces of the Shakespearean literature. But of course, he moves them so fully that they now go after Brutus and Cassius and those others trying to kill them. And those guys escape, and that's the beginning of the civil war, which ultimately brings Octavian, Caesar's nephew, to power, and he becomes Augustus, the first emperor of Rome.
But I think we should make clear that that wasn't Mark Antony that we heard.
Not the real Mark Antony, no. It was an English actor, a very good one as well. What mechanisms of rhetoric are illustrated there? One thing that you notice immediately was this device. He talks about all of Caesar's great virtues and how he's benefited the Republic, yet, and repeats again and again, yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man.
There are two things going on there. One is the repetition of that phrase, and the other is the accumulation of details that prove to the contrary. So that what Mark Antony is doing in this speech is undermining what he claims to be overtly upholding. So that all of the reasons to believe that that they're not honorable eventually undercut this repetitive claim that they are.
Is there a Greek term for that device?
There probably is, but I don't know what it is. The other thing that's really interesting about this is the way the double entendre works.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're throughout here, this being the most obvious example, there's one thing being said and another message actually being communicated at the same time.
Do you find any parallels in modern political discourse?
Most modern political discourse is much less subtle.
Yeah.
Even in some fairly obvious cases, people will call attention to these discrepancies. Nixon at one point said, you know, pay attention to what we do, not what we say.
Uh-huh.
Calling attention to the fact that they're working at cross purposes. This is a speech where they artfully work at cross purposes without the orator calling attention to it.
One of the great themes of oratory is to fire up men to go run the risk of getting killed in battle. Not an easy task.
That's right.
And we've got some great speeches which do that. We're going to hear yet another Shakespearean speech, the one delivered by Henry V on St. Crispin's Day. Before, what battle is it? The Battle of Agincourt, I guess, of course. That's to follow right after we pause for this. And we return to David Zaretsky, who is our guide through the rich tradition of oratory. And through the wisdom of the rhetoricians, which was propounded a long time ago, but which still applies and is still to some degree, I suppose, invoked, whether consciously or otherwise, by our politicians and our public persons. There are so many different occasions when one makes a speech. The most common speech these days has as its basic purpose, vote for me, and don't vote for the other guy, he's a scoundrel. What are some of the other major purposes of oratory? As we hear it these days.
As we hear it these days, there are a number of ceremonial occasions, inaugural addresses,
to be sure.
State of the Union addresses, mm-hmm. We just heard one recently. There are speeches to mobilize people to support or oppose a particular measure. There are eulogies to praise the dead.
We heard 50 of those or something today for
Coretta
Scott King.
That's right. There are... there's a whole species, obviously, of courtroom oratory to influence juries to determine guilt or innocence.
My client is falsely accused.
That's right.
No, your client is the murderer.
That's right. But a lot of what we hear these days is more on ceremonial occasions and in election campaigns.
But one other great purpose of oratory, and it's been used constantly throughout all history, is to energize people who are scared silly because they have to go into battle and run a high risk of getting killed, and to kind of nerve them up to fight the fight.
That's right.
And we've had speeches of that sort as long as there have been wars, undoubtedly.
It's a staple in the rhetoric of war to motivate people to make what is, in one sense, an irrational kind of sacrifice.
And we are going to hear a famous speech of that sort, again as imagined by Shakespeare, but again he's drawing very closely upon real history. This is before the Battle of Agincourt. Henry V has led the troops over from England to invade France. They've had a hard time, and they are almost against their will forced into fighting this battle against a French force which is 4 to 5 times greater. But the British do win. It is a famous battle, as one has it fully represented in Shakespeare's play, Henry V. Here is Laurence Olivier in the film that he made of this towards the end of World War II. This is a great oration. I think we should analyze it after we hear it. How does he manage to get these guys not only to go face death and to fight the fight, but in fact to so nerve them up that they win against a force 4 times greater than their own?
Oh, that we now had here but 10,000 of those men in England who do not work today.
What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? No, my fair cousin. If we are marched to die, we are enough to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honor. God's will, I pray thee, wish not one man more. Rather proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this feast, let him depart. His passport shall be drawn, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is St. Crispian. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin, say. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son. And Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap. While Denny speaks, that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Would that send you into battle?
I don't think so, but it surely illustrates some of the techniques that are often used for that purpose.
What are they?
I mean, essentially what's happening here is that the situation's being recontextualized. It's being put in a whole different framework. So that it's not an individual group of people who are asked to put themselves at great risk of death, but this event is, first of all, recontextualized in time. The speaker imagines many years down the road how it will be remembered and told, and it will be told...
How proud you'll be for the rest of your life.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And it'll be told in such a way as to link these people with the historic significance of this day.
And any man who fights in this battle is my brother.
That's the other thing that's recontextualized, is these are now not individual soldiers who happen simply to be together for purpose of battle, but there is a blood bond between them, a familial bond, and you feel toward one another as you would toward brothers, and that motivates people to act.
We don't have it on our playlist, but I speak to my friends in the booth. Let's dig out, if it's readily available, the speech from the Patton film. This is George Scott explaining to the troops that what war is and what they've got to do to fight. It's a very different sort of speech in advance of battle or a whole series of battles to come. I hope that it's readily available. I look for a signal telling me that it is, and here it is.
Men, all this stuff you heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans.
That's not the whole speech, but you remember he ends it by saying, your job is to kill the bastard who's trying to kill you.
This is obviously a different style from the Shakespearean speech, but it's trying to accomplish exactly the same purpose.
Do you think it's effective?
Yes, yes. Certainly for the time and for the situation.
The mechanism is somehow an appeal to your being an American, and Americans welcome such challenge.
Well, and it's an association of being an American with competitiveness and with success.
Mm-hmm. Didn't quite work for the soldiers who referred to him. He was known as Blood and Guts, and the slogan that they would whisper as he came by is, "Our blood and his guts." We've got to pause for another round of commercials. Then we come to somebody you've chosen, and to be sure, he's a very interesting historical figure. And now we go to the legislative mode of oratory. Edmund Burke, possibly the greatest figure in British parliamentary history. And you'll explain why and how, and we'll hear some of a famous oration of his concerning the American Revolution, which is being waged at the time that he's speaking in the House of Commons. Directly back to David Zarefsky and on to Edmund Burke after these words. And directly back to an old friend of ours, David Zarefsky, who is professor of communications at Northwestern University. He's an expert in the history and criticism of U.S. public discourse. But now we're talking about British public discourse. Burke is considered, I guess, a great orator, but more than that, a very significant political thinker.
Yes, he was a distinguished member of Parliament. He was recognized for his integrity and his independence of thought. We think of him today as something of a classic conservative because he very much favored making decisions mm-hmm. based on principle and not just following what the majority wanted or what seemed to be popular at a particular time. But he's probably best remembered, at least in this country, for a speech that he gave in 1775 in which he advocated that Britain adopt a conciliatory stance toward the rebellious colonies. There was a great debate going on in Parliament about how to respond to mm-hmm. the Boston Tea Party and other acts of colonial defiance of parliamentary legislation. And the clear majority view was these are disobedient, rebellious children and they need to be punished. So we need further harsh measures so that the rebels will see the light and others will be deterred. And Burke opposed that view. He opposed the use of force against the colonies and argued for taking a conciliatory stance. And let me just share a few paragraphs out of what's a fairly long speech.
By all means.
First, sir, permit me to observe that the use of force alone is but temporary. It may subdue for a moment, but it does not remove the necessity of subduing again. And a nation is not governed, which is perpetually to be conquered. My next objection is its uncertainty. Terror is not always the effect of force, and an armament is not a victory. If you do not succeed, you are without resource, for conciliation failing, force remains, but force failing, no further hope of reconciliation is left. Power and authority are sometimes bought by kindness, but they can never be begged as alms by an impoverished and defeated violence. A further objection to force is that you impair the object by your very endeavors to preserve it. The thing you fought for is not the thing which you recover, but depreciated, sunk, wasted, and consumed in the contest. Nothing less will content me than whole America. I do not choose to consume its strength along with our own, because in all parts it is the British strength that I consume. I do not choose to be caught by a foreign enemy at the end of this exhausting conflict, and still less in the midst of it. I may escape, but I can make no insurance against such an event. Let me add that I do not choose wholly to break the American spirit, because it is the spirit that has made the country. Lastly, we have no sort of experience in favor of force as an instrument in the rule of our colonies. Their growth and their utility have been owing to methods altogether different. Our ancient indulgence has been said to be pursued to a fault. It may be so, but we know, if feeling is evidence, that our fault was more tolerable than our attempt to mend it, and our sin far more salutary than our penitence. These, sir, are my reasons for not entertaining that high opinion of untried force by which many gentlemen, for whose sentiments in other particulars I have great respect, seem to be so greatly captivated. I think what's remarkable about that is it's a very well-organized set of objections, and the objections are grounded in observation and experience, where the case for force is being made in a really hypothetical kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
So Burke is really arguing here in the way that we've come to regard as the classic conservative, that this would not be a prudent thing to do. Regardless of what we may think about our justification or our rights, it's not a course of action we ought to pursue for the four separate reasons as he lays them out.
It's very closely reasoned.
It is.
This is ratiocinative.
It is.
Discourse.
That's right.
Let me reason with you.
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, that's at least in theory, a characteristic of discourse in the legislative setting,
mm-hmm.
where people come together to deliberate and reach a decision about public matters in the face of uncertainty. And that's exactly what Burke is putting into practice in this speech.
Yet, curiously, with regard to another revolution, the French Revolution, he didn't necessarily advocate we go in there and punish the French revolutionaries, but he was extremely negative towards them and condemning of them.
That's right. That's right. Of course, they were not English at heart.
You know,
there wasn't the sense of common bond that he appeals to in some of the reasons that he develops in this speech.
What would you find if you went into Hansard or whatever documentation is? These are his real words.
Yes.
These are all taken down and transcribed in Parliament. What would the level of discourse be generally as it flowed from other members of Parliament on that day or in that period? Would they all be quite as grandiloquent as Burke is?
No. They would certainly be more deliberative and more reasoned than we have been accustomed to in recent years.
Their language would be somewhat more rounded and more orotund, would it not?
Yes, it would. It would. But there's also the active give and take, the interruptions and the heckling and the questioning that is very much a part of the give and take of this dialogue.
That's something that one still enjoys from the British Parliament as we see it on cable television. Once a week, I think.
That's right.
In the answer session.
The question time.
The question time session.
Question
yeah.
time.
Where the Prime Minister faces the opposition, who are heckling him usually.
Yes.
Do we have anything like that in American parliamentary procedure or
no,
legislative
we don't.
Procedure?
No, we don't. Not in American parliamentary procedure. The closest we get to it in America is campaigning on the stump.
Yeah.
And we see less and less of that as the campaign events are much more carefully controlled as far as who's there.
I see that we're somewhat, we're almost up to the point where we've got to stop for a newscast. We've done all the commercials for this hour, so I've got a minute and a half left before that. So where are we in our overview now, as developed with many examples? Where are we as we try to outline a general theory of, or some basic principles of rhetoric?
Well, we've come all the way from the classical period to the 18th century, which was another high watermark for rhetorical practice and rhetorical theory. At the same time Burke is speaking, there's an outpouring of writing on the theory of effective discourse, which is taking Ciceronian principles and bringing them forward with respect to different kinds of appeal and different parts of the mind that respond to different sorts of appeal, and the relation between the character that one displays in oratory and the persuasiveness of the oratory. So we've seen a development that's obviously not without ebbs and flows, but it's a fairly steady development over centuries.
And now, coming up in modern history, is World War II, which was an occasion, to be sure, for some major speechifying. When we return, we're going to hear the voice of the man who, more than any other, is responsible for World War II, Adolf Hitler. A mode of public oratory which is rather startling, for even if one doesn't understand the language, for the different style. And one needs to figure out why he was so deeply appreciated by the Germans as a great orator. That is supposed to have been the key to his original political success. And right back to David Zarefsky, I was struggling a bit just a moment ago to place Hitler in this context. It's a very different sort of speech, a very different sort of oratorical performance. Yet surely it's been done in the past as well. I let everything flow out, all my excessive emotion, as a way of capturing you. Supposedly that works better. I don't know whether we find that in American politics, but we find it...
Not usually. Yeah. Not usually.
Let's hear it, just as a phenomenal force. This is the campaign which brings the Nazis to power. This is a campaign speech, and he's ridiculing the fact that there are some 35 other political parties, and that he's criticized for not trying to cooperate with them. And he says, we want to get rid of all of them. That's, democracy is crazy. You can't do it this way. But his heart is, the blood is flowing. And he's tearing a passion to shreds, one might say, which is what he almost always did. Here it is.
Die Gegner werfen uns Nationalsozialisten vor und mir insbesondere, dass wir intolerante, unverträgliche Menschen seien. Wir wollten, sagen sie, mit anderen Parteien nicht arbeiten. Und ein starker Politiker verschärft das noch, indem er sagt, die Nationalsozialisten sind überhaupt nicht deutsch, denn sie lehnen die Arbeit mit anderen Parteien ab. Also ist es typisch deutsch, 30 Parteien zu besitzen. Ich habe hier eines zu erklären. Die Herren haben ganz recht. Wir sind intolerant. Ich habe mir ein Ziel gestellt, nämlich die 30 Parteien aus Deutschland hinauszufegen. Sie verbessern uns mit ihresgleichen selbst. Wir haben ein Ziel uns gewählt und was besseres vernaht es rücksichtslos bis ins Grab hinein.
The basic method seems to be say it all in a shout at the top of your lungs as if you're about to expire with passion.
Yes, I should make clear, I don't understand German. But just listening to this to this message, you can see how the intensity builds, how it accelerates from when this excerpt began to when it ends.
Uh-huh.
And it is, as you say, just the passion coming out. And so the intensity with which he feels this is a part of the message that, you know, if it's that important, if it's that critical, if it's that urgent, then, you know, maybe it's right. This is also, of course, a reminder that rhetoric is not necessarily an instrument for good, which was part of the problem that Aristotle and Plato were writing about. It's an instrument that can be used for good or for evil.
And it can be used for evil or for good, I suppose, through transport rather than through rationality and logic.
Absolutely.
He's just nerving them up to a degree of emotional arousal which blots out rational thought.
That's right. That's right. Now, in what we would tend to regard as some of the best oratory, the emotionalism and the rationality are not at odds. They're calibrated with each other, so that there is a rational basis for the appeal, but to get people to act, you've always got to move beyond just that.
But this was by them seen, and by him it was seen, as a kind of virtually a religious occasion.
Yes.
That is to say, there was something mystical about it. He said more than once, everything that I am. He said this, shrieked it to audiences. Everything that I am only through you. But everything that you are only through me. Alles, was ich bin, bin ich nur durch euch, aber alles, was ihr seid, sind sie nur durch mich. And they screamed in absolute approval and delight, because there was a great mystical truth that he delivered to them. He used it again and again, that very line.
Yeah, and that kind of appeal, not always so personalized, is part of nationalism. It's part of how a nationalistic spirit is developed, whether in Germany or in this country or anywhere else. The difference is that we have a very low tolerance for personalizing it in the way that he did.
What do we know about the orations of Napoleon?
I know very little.
He must have done something similar. Of course, he's basically speaking to troops.
Right.
And so he's nerving them up for battle also. But they had great, great loyalty to him personally. So again, it was this matter of charismatic extension of individuality so that it becomes, in a way, symbolic for the whole tribe.
Yes, yes. Although, I mean, using that appeal for the mass population is probably much more a 20th century phenomenon.
To be sure, to be sure. And what about the rhetorician who was at Hitler's side, Dr. Goebbels? Have you read him on propaganda?
Yes.
What does he add to Aristotle and to Cicero?
Well, from my point of view, I think a kind of cynicism about the audience and what the audience is capable of.
He says they're a beast.
Yeah. I mean, Aristotle and Cicero regard the audience as rational, critical people to whose judgment one appeals and the results of whose judgment one accepts. Goebbels is seeing the audience as you say, a beast, to be worked with and manipulated.
Yeah.
So the persuasion becomes just a matter of technique, the application of technique.
And if you got to lie, lie again and again and again. Repeat the lie and it becomes truth.
Right.
He says that. That's
right.
One of the principles.
That's right.
The war begins. That speech from Hitler is 1933, but by 1939, the war begins. And it goes very badly in the beginning for the British. The French are defeated, and Britain is the only power left standing before December 7th and before America enters. Here's a famous speech by a very famous orator, Winston Churchill. I think this is also in an address that he's making on a transatlantic hookup to the United States. This is the famous "We will fight them on the beaches" speech. You have anything you want to say about it before we hear it?
Let's hear it first.
Here it is.
We are told, sir, that Herr Hitler has a plan for invading the British Isles. This has often been thought of before. When Napoleon laid Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottomed boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British Expeditionary Force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it when subjugated and starving, then our empire, beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
I had that wrong. That was played in America, and at the very end, the reference is to America, which has not yet come into the war, and he's hoping they will come into the war.
And goading them.
He's goading them. But that obviously was spoken as a speech in Parliament.
That's right.
The sir he refers to is the presiding officer of Parliament. What about Churchill as an orator? Is he doing something different, or is he in the classical mode?
He's in the classical mode. I think the thing that is really distinctive about Churchill is his cadence, the way that he constructs these sentences so that there's a momentum to them and a staccato quality to them, and there's series of things that he puts together that build momentum. I actually remember that line, "We'll fight on the beaches, we'll fight on the landing fields," as if it were delivered more intensely than he had delivered it, with a kind of increasing emotion to it, because that's the way it's written. There's a momentum in the prose that carries the speech forward.
It's interesting to remember the speech in Fulton, Missouri, which initiates the Cold War, officially, more or less.
That's a speech that Churchill gave after the war was over, when he had been voted out of office, and he was invited to the U.S. by his good friend President Truman. And he proclaimed, it's not the Cold War, it's the Iron Curtain.
The Iron Curtain. From Stettin in the Baltic to
Trieste in the Adriatic.
An Iron Curtain has descended over Europe.
And this was a message that most Americans were not yet ready to hear.
Mm-hmm.
We had not given up on the possibility of collaboration with the Soviet Union. And in particular, we were not ready to do what Churchill called for in that speech, which was a formal alliance between Britain and the United States. So that's a case of a Churchill speech that was really out of sync with where the audience was, and where he didn't really succeed, at least in the short run, in moving the audience forward. Of course, in the long run, that speech is remembered as being prophetic.
And it had its influence.
It certainly did.
It provided, in fact, a symbol, a great symbol, the Iron Curtain descending. We get into the war, as everyone knows, and everyone knows how we got into the war. A great day is coming. Ultimately, it's D-Day. And from the broad range of recorded materials by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we've chosen a fireside chat. And that was something he initiated. We need to talk about that. He'd done many of them. But this is his fireside chat on D-Day. But first, say something, if you would, about the fireside chat, which is really an adaptation of the art of oratory to the new electronic institution of the radio.
The radio really calls into question some of the traditional assumptions of oratory, that it's a single orator speaking to a mass audience that's assembled for the occasion. The radio fragments the audience, so people hear these messages in the privacy and comfort of their living rooms.
And it renders the communication more intimate in a way.
That's right. And the fireside chats are an attempt to recognize that. They don't sound like formal orations.
Exactly.
They sound like conversations that would be taking place as though the President of the United States were with you there in your living room. And Roosevelt was really the first major political figure to recognize that the changing technology required changing the conventions of oratory if it was to be successful.
Shall we hear him on D-Day?
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization. and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in Thee in this hour of great sacrifice.
What do you make of that?
Well, this, you know, this really doesn't illustrate as well what we were saying about the fireside chats as some of his others might,
no.
Where he uses homely analogies and a conversational tone and so on. This one is, as you heard, in the form of a prayer, and that's a more formal occasion.
You know, it occurs to me, listening to it, it's really an advanced funeral oration.
In a way. But I could also picture people all across the country hearing that over the radio, joining in with the president in that prayer and being very much connected with what he was saying. And that was what the fireside chats really did, in a way that contemporary speeches from the Oval Office or the president addressing the nation don't really usually do.
In fact, if you don't have the visual, I think it's more potent.
Yes.
There's a little bit more mystery to it.
That's right.
And that patrician articulation of his and resonance of his worked so wonderfully well upon the American public.
It was really ironic in a way, because those were things that separated him from the public. And yet in his wording, in his word choices, uses of examples, his ability to explain things simply and clearly, he was able to establish this kind of bond with people who really had no connection at all with him in terms of social class or background or anything like that.
I wonder, after him, when it comes to American presidents, was a similar bond ever established? Possibly with Reagan.
Possibly with Reagan, and for some people, certainly with Kennedy.
Yeah.
Although there, you know, our memories play tricks on us. And the bonds with Kennedy are seen much more clearly in retrospect than they probably were at the time.
But here comes another man in American politics who indeed became president, though this goes back to his run as the vice presidential candidate along with Eisenhower. I have in mind, of course, Richard Nixon and the crisis he faced and the famous Checkers speech by which he extricated himself from that crisis. We are going to hear that after we pause for this. And back to David Zarefsky. You were saying and telling me during this brief commercial break that the Nixon Checkers speech is in a category which, again, dates way back to classical antiquity.
That's right. It's referred to as apologia, which doesn't really mean apology in the sense that we would think of it as, I'm sorry. It's a speech of self-defense in response to an accusation that goes to the heart of one's character. And in this case, as many of us remember, the accusation made against Nixon was that he was profiting from a secret fund that was set up. And in responding to that charge, what Nixon really offers is a full-blown defense of his character.
And he works an interesting trick with regard to the pet dog.
Yes.
Just as earlier Roosevelt had worked an interesting trick with regard to his pet dog, Fowler.
Yes. Back in the campaign of 1944, the Republicans were charging that Roosevelt was wasting the taxpayers' money, sending a military airplane to pick up Fowler, who had been left, I believe it was, in Alaska.
Exactly, yes.
And the Roosevelt's response was to make fun of the charge and say, the Republicans aren't content with attacking me or my family. They've now included my dog, Fowler. And then proceeded to say, Fowler resents these attacks. And so there's an interesting connection, whether intended or not, between the dog Fowler and the dog Checkers.
Here's the famous Checkers speech.
My fellow Americans, I come before you tonight as a candidate for the vice presidency and as a man whose honesty and integrity has been questioned. Now, the usual political thing to do when charges are made against you is to either ignore them or to deny them without giving details. I believe we've had enough of that in the United States, particularly with the present administration in Washington, D.C. To me, the office of the Vice Presidency of the United States is a great office, and I feel that the people have got to have confidence in the integrity of the men who run for that office and who might obtain it. I have a theory, too, that the best and only answer to a smear or to an honest misunderstanding of the facts is to tell the truth. And that's why I'm here tonight. I want to tell you my side of the case. Well, that's about it. That's what we have, and that's what we owe. It isn't very much, but Pat and I have the satisfaction that every dime that we've got is honestly ours. I should say this, that Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat. And I always tell her that she'd look good in anything. One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat on the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checker. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
That's the beginning and the end. We've left out a large part of the apologia, which comes in the middle. But that's a great trick, isn't it?
It is. It is. When I play this speech for students now, people laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just remarkably effective in regaining public support and stimulating calls for Nixon to stay on the ticket. And, in fact, Eisenhower kept him on the ticket. Yeah.
It humanized the Nixons.
It did.
It would have been better for him if he had lost the nomination and then hadn't got to the presidency. Or would it? I don't know.
Well, that's a question you can't answer by reference to the speeches.
But the only president who ever had to resign during his presidency. Do we have other examples of modern apologia?
Well, one that comes to mind, we were talking about this before, is Senator Edward Kennedy's speech following the Chappaquiddick incident in 1969.
What explanation? I don't remember it. What explanation did he give?
It was actually about a week after the episode, and there were calls for him to resign as a result of this lapse. And he gave a speech in which he, as I recall, recounted the events of the night and how the car went off the bridge, and announced that he had pleaded guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident, which, of course, in most people's minds was peripheral to the story. But went on to say that this was a misjudgment and that he took responsibility for it, and talked about some of the things that may have led him to it. And then he appealed ultimately to the voters of Massachusetts, since, of course, technically that's who had sent him to the Senate. He appealed to the voters of Massachusetts to decide what he should do. I suspect, knowing full well that Massachusetts voters would support him. But nevertheless, it followed really all of the standard features of the speech of apologia, in which he acknowledges the attacks that have been made against him, explains his conduct, defends his course of action, and appeals for support.
What was the name of the woman left in the car?
Mary Jo Kopechne.
Kopechne, exactly. What did he have to say about why and how he abandoned her?
He talked about that he was disoriented from the car going off himself, and how difficult it was to extricate himself from the car, and how in that moment he just lost the sense of judgment and, you know, swam to the shore, and then he was just exhausted, and it was hours later before he realized what had happened, and then he immediately went to the police and reported it. I mean, that's the account that's in the speech.
A similar apologia, I suppose, was attempted with regard to a very different matter by another actual president of the United States, namely Bill Clinton.
The speech that Clinton gave in August of 1998 after his testimony to the grand jury is, I think, a really good example of a failed apologia. And it's a failure because it's incomplete. He acknowledges responsibility and says he's misled people. He doesn't say he's lied. He doesn't say he's had a sexual relationship, just that he's had an improper relationship. And then he very quickly goes on to the attack against Ken Starr, the special prosecutor, and against the very divisive partisan climate in Washington. And he appeals for privacy and says, this is my business. You know, stay out of it.
Yeah, this is before the impeachment.
That's
entered.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So what he's done really is he's not offered an explanation and defense of his character. He has sort of accepted responsibility, but in a kind of tangential way, and then has immediately turned to the attack. And this I think is in good part why this speech backfired.
Doesn't he in the same speech also inform us that he's now going to be taking some counseling from religious figures?
I don't believe he mentions that in the speech. He may have, but very shortly after this...
It is announced. Yeah. It is time for us to pause for the usual reasons, and also to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines. The number, of course, 591-7200. And now's the time to give us a ring if you want to raise a question about anything you've heard, or offer a thought about other models of oratory and other great orators whom you think ought to be remembered. 591-7200. Also relevant, I suppose, is your estimation or your questions about David Zarefsky's estimation of contemporary political figures and their oratorical skills or lack thereof. 591-7200. And for that matter, if you want to email us, extension 720@tribune.com. Get the calls and emails in quickly. We shall be with you shortly, though we also have more clips that we're going to be playing before we finish tonight. And we will go to the phones on 591-7200. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to ask how he would classify Douglas MacArthur's speech at West Point, the duty, honor, country speech. I find that an amazing love letter that he writes and speaks to West Point at the end of his life. And I didn't go to West Point, but I went to one of the service schools. And, you know, it kind of just, it gets me by the throat every time I hear it.
David, does it affect you that way, in the throat?
Not quite the same, but it's a very powerful speech. It's a farewell speech, at the end of his career, where he's really summing up what the experience has meant to him and inspiring the cadets at West Point. It's one of the speeches for which MacArthur is most well known.
And here's another for which he's well known. This is the end of his speech to Congress shortly after he's been recalled from Japan, or rather from Korea, by Harry Truman.
But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
He had a large portion of Ham in his oratorical style.
He certainly did, and he had a great sense of timing. Now, the speech that you played is about a decade earlier than the one that the caller is asking about, but they're probably the two most powerful and most well-known of MacArthur's speeches.
How well did Gregory Peck do as Doug MacArthur?
Okay.
Yeah. Not quite the same stuff there.
Not quite the same.
We played something last night, which I find so moving. Last night we had Taylor Branch here, and with his third and final volume in his monumental biography of Martin Luther King, Jr. And this is Martin Luther King's last speech, the one the very night before his assassination. And though we played it only last night, I was so moved hearing it again it seems to me it fits. This is of a different order. Let's talk about what it is and what it represents in the nature of oratory and the classificatory system that you're using after we hear it.
Now, it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said, over the public address system, we are sorry for the delay. But we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Yeah. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
And by 6 or 7 in the evening of the following day, he's standing on the balcony at that motel, and he's shot down by James Earl Ray. It's so prophetic and such a chilling and moving thing to hear.
It is. It is. First of all, I'm glad that we've included Dr. King in our list tonight. Mm-hmm. He's probably one of the most outstanding examples of American orators in the 20th century. And what he managed so skillfully to do is to merge the tradition of African-American preaching, mm-hmm. out of which he came, with politics and policy, so that he's not only not separating it from questions of morality and religion, but seeing it as the acting out of moral and religious struggles. So it's no accident, for example, that he talks about the civil rights movement in the terms of the Exodus. And his seeing the promised land is, of course, reenacting the role of Moses in the scriptures. It's remarkable, of course, that he can sort of imagine what it turns out tragically is going to happen.
We've got another significant African American in a very different sort of speech. I'm going to make this sort of a surprise and keep it mysterious for just a moment, but we'll hear it directly after we pause for these words. And directly back to David Zarefsky. And David, I think you know that something I've got in reserve here, and we're going to play it right now, is Bill Cosby, of all people. This is a speech he gave to the NAACP on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, of that Supreme Court ruling. And he is really in some ways being very critical of black leadership for not having directly addressed the problem of a condescension toward the standards of education on the part of many young blacks, particularly, I would suppose, within the inner city culture. And is using as well his comic gifts, but this is really very serious stuff. It got him into a lot of trouble with some blacks, and much commended by yet others who said he's telling it like it really is. Here's an excerpt from that speech.
In the old days, you couldn't hook his school because behind every drawn shade was an eye. And before your mother got off the bus into the house, she knew exactly where you had gone, who had gone into the house. Parents don't know that today. I'm talking about these people who cry when their son is standing there in an orange suit. Where were you when he was two? Where were you when he was 12? Where were you when he was 18? And how come you don't know he had a pistol? These are not political criminals. These are people going around stealing Coca-Cola. People getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. And then we all run out and we're outraged. Oh, the cop shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand? Brown versus the Board of Education is no longer the white person's problem. We've got to take the neighborhood back. We've got to go in there. It's right around the corner. It's standing on the corner. It can't speak English. It doesn't want to speak English. Instead, I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is, go wild back. I don't know who these people are. And I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk. And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house. Everybody knows it's important to speak English, except these knuckleheads. You can't land a plane with why you ain't where you can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth. Why can't you hit the streets? Why can't you clean it out yourself? It's our time now, ladies and gentlemen. It is our time. And I have good news for you. It's not about money. It's about you doing something that ordinarily we do. Get in somebody else's business. It's time for you to not accept this language that these people are speaking, which will take them nowhere. What the hell good is Brown versus the Board of Education if nobody wants it? I mean, this is the future, and all of these people who've lined up and done whatever, they've got to be wondering, what the hell happened? Brown versus the Board of Education. These people who marched and were hit in the face with rocks and punched in the face to get an education. And we got these knuckleheads walking around, don't want to learn English. When you go to the church, look at the stained glass things of Jesus. Look at them. Is Jesus smiling? Not in one picture. So tell your friends, let's try to do something. Let's try and make Jesus smile. Let's start parenting. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, David, what do you make of that? That hardly fits, or does it, the classic rules of rhetoric and oratory?
Not very obviously. It fits in some ways. I mean, it's a sign of the maturation of a movement that its spokespeople are willing to be self-critical and to identify internal failings as well as threats from outside. And, of course, that's also what makes it controversial, is that not everybody in the audience wants to hear that.
Well, many in the audience were much offended.
That's right.
Al Sharpton attacked him the very next day for this.
Right. Right, because it seems like it's minimizing what is still a real and continuing external threat or external problem. But this call to take ownership and to take responsibility for a situation is sort of like the tradition of mobilizing people for action in combat. Mm-hmm. It's just in a different kind of setting.
Interestingly, he brings to that speech the comic's gift for mockery.
Yeah, and in some ways, his comics gift is what makes the message easier to take mm-hmm. for people who might otherwise be offended by
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Huh. Only a few minutes left. Let's go back to a few more phone calls. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I was listening in the car before, and when you were talking about the Mark Anthony's speech at Caesar's funeral, and how it was that he said one thing and meant something else. And I just thought back to this morning. I watched President Clinton give a speech at Coretta Scott King's funeral,
mm-hmm.
And his speech said one thing, and there was an element of that speech that was never said, but which to me seemed loud and clear, and that was some encouraging notion that his wife might run for the presidency.
Really? I did not hear the speech this morning.
I didn't either, so I really can't comment on that.
Well, one of the things that he did, which I found fascinating, was talking about his president and his past presidents, and then almost you thought he was going to say maybe the next president, but he didn't say it. There was clearly an element there of saying something that wasn't said, and I was impressed by it this morning. And then when you talked about Caesar's funeral, it came home again.
That's often done to make an argument incompletely on the assumption that the audience can fill in the missing step. There's actually a term for that, which is called enthymeme. It's an argument where part of it comes from the beliefs or the values of the audience and is left unsaid.
Well, there you go. I am enjoying this program very much.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Sure enough.
Jimmy Carter, in an excerpt I heard from the speech he gave at Coretta King's funeral today, takes a sideswipe at the current president, because he talks about the telephone surveillance and the general bugging that was done by the FBI on the Kings. And he works that in a way which clearly makes some reference to the present question concerning surveillance without judicial approval.
And if he had left completely implicit the present reference, thinking that people, of course, will see that mm-hmm. parallel. That would be another example of this same technique.
Yeah. Shall we work in one more quick call? Here it is. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. When I heard you talk about Ted Kennedy, I recall that he appealed for sympathy to the public, saying there was some sort of curse following his family, and trying to somehow relate the event which happened to him as a curse. And there was a feeling at that time that many people had that there was a curse connected with the Kennedy family. So I just wonder what your comment is on his this appeal for sympathy, and maybe that had something to do with his staying in office.
Well, as I recall, he mentioned that in a list of possible explanations. You know, maybe this, maybe this, maybe there really is a curse against the Kennedys. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, was very current at the time because it was so soon after Robert Kennedy's assassination. As I recall, the reaction to that in the speech was fairly negative, that he had gone too far in saying that. And I don't recall that line in particular evoking sympathy for him.
We've just got about a minute left. Who in contemporary public life, David, strikes you as the most effective speaker? Or who are what one or two stand out?
You know, I don't know that there is one or two. There have certainly been moments in which President Bush has been quite effective and other mm-hmm. moments in which he's been extremely ineffective. What we've seen so far of our new Senator Barack Obama suggests some real potential for distinguishing himself as a speaker or as a public orator. You know, there are many people. There's not one or two that uniquely stand out.
But there's nobody who quite matches some of the great orators we've heard tonight.
I don't think so.
Have the times so altered verbal skill or audience expectations that you can't do it the way they used to do it?
Well, you can't do it the way they used to do it, but you can achieve the same effects. I mean, for many people, Ronald Reagan did, with some very different stylistic devices in a very different setting, but he certainly was well known for his oratory.
He was indeed. It's been great fun having you here once again, and you have actually illuminated wonderfully well some of the materials that we've heard in the brief clips that we've played. David Zarefsky has been our guest tonight, professor of communications at Northwestern University.